Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamatasa Tavara Ye Sotavanta Bamunchantu Sadhang. This is the new moon of November. This year's nearly over. It's gone by very quickly. And we're already getting ready for the winter retreat. Seems like we just finished the winter retreat. And of course, this is we reaffirm our commitment to the precepts, the bhikkhus 227 and the samaneras, the 10 anagarikas, the 8 precepts. And this is the tradition, convention, that the form that we use. And so it's just to, and the practice is the cultivation of awareness, mindfulness. And so the conventional world, the conventions that we live in, or that we're using, or just the structures of this that we have in this realm that we're experiencing. Beginning to recognize and to awaken to the fact of the conventions as not as ends in themselves, they're not as things to identify with, but if we use the conventions in a useful way, then they help us. They're limitations, the sila on behavior, on action and speech, not as some kind of personal need to control yourself, but as moving towards simplicity. Or just like we talk about renunciation, and that word itself can mean kind of like having to give up things that we like and we don't think are, you know, we've got to learn how to relinquish or give up pleasure or fun or sensuality. Or we can see it as just simplicity, moving towards a more simple way of living. And when it gets into kind of puritanical approaches, then it is always, you know, trying to control ourselves, trying to fight off the evil forces, temptation, and all that through discipline is one way of looking at it. And I think that's probably quite an ordinary way to look at it from our own cultural background, which is one of very controlling attitudes, very idealistic, and based on a kind of dualistic sense of having to resist and fight against the evil forces. We can see this, you know, just what's happening in Afghanistan, the Americans fighting against, trying to get rid of the evil Taliban. And I'm like, this mindset is quite familiar to most of us. But then this is only working on a convention level only. And of course, I'm sure the Taliban don't see themselves as the evil force. They see the Americans as the evil force. I mean, and this is a matter of who is and who isn't. Conventional reality is always confusing because it is always a complication of some sort. You know, it makes more of everything than what it really is. And so we live in this realm of convention or of conditionality. It's the body itself, the being incarcerated in a human form, just being able to experience pleasure and pain and feel happy and sad. The changing conditions, the weather, of the world political system or the economy or family, community. It works on all levels in the same sense of this incessant kind of ineluctable change that is going on, but which if we only know the conventional world or the conditioned realm, and that's all we ever recognize or we allow ourselves to experience, then that's the way it seems. There's always an endless sense of an ongoing relentless sense of always having to control something, to get rid of the bad and hold on to the good. So then the awakening, the Buddha is the awakened consciousness. The Buddha then, this word itself, he means awake. So, and it's a simple act of paying attention, of opening to this realm, not through trying to define it through conventions, but trusting in your own kind of intuitive sense and wisdom that come through the simple imminent act of waking up and paying attention, noticing, observing, reflecting upon the way it is. No, it sounds very simple. It is very simple. It's not at all complicated. It's going to ultimate simplicity. But then the conventions that we use seem very complicated. 227 Patimokkha rules, which we recite, which Venerable Kongrit recited today, and then all the other precepts in the Vinaya Pitaka, and it all sounds very complicated indeed, you know. How do we work this one out? With all kinds of major and minor rules, what we call rules or precepts. So then we think, well, maybe just not have any precepts, and then that's moving towards it. We'll renounce precepts, and the idea of not complicating anything. But then, most of us who've attempted that, say the more libertine, hedonistic approaches, where we renounce precepts and just live according to our feelings. What is the result of that? You know, what we feel like, or what we, you know, what, or you know, as an ideal of just being free, and being able to do what we want, with no restraint, no judgment, no restriction. And so that might sound very inspiring, and it's very idealistic, you know, it has its beauty and it's very attractive. But yet, in terms of our own, where we are right now, the way it is for each one of us at this moment, if we're not arahants, then that could be a very difficult thing to really be free at every moment. We might like the idea of that and really long for that, but yet we're so enslaved and bound into our conditioning, our habit, our habitual behavior, which is based on this duality of fear, a lot of fear and desires, not understanding how desires operate and the fear that we all have about fear of being hurt, of harm, of being humiliated, of being rejected, of being hurt in some way. Because this realm, you know, in terms of experiences, there's a lot to fear. You know, there's so many things we have no control over. They just happen. They're just like the 11 September catastrophe in New York City, or the airplane that crashed the other day, and not to mention, you know, lesser dangers. Or not so kind of dramatic ones, but this realm that we live in, it can be a jungle of survival of the fittest, just trying to you know, survive as best we can on this planet where everything, where we have no control and we just have to learn how to survive in it. That's one way of looking at it. And that, of course, is coming out of fear. That's a fear realm. So awakening then is beginning to recognize fear for what it is. What is fear as we experience it in our own conscious experience? A sense of anxiety or worry, the unknown, the dark, the black holes, the future. What's going to happen to us in the future? And death, of course, the big unknown. What is death all about? And that word death can even make a chill run up and down the spine, fear, because it's unknown. So the awakening, isn't it? We're not trying to get run away anymore, or to kind of distract ourselves from the dark or conditions of fear, but awakening to them. What are they like? What is it? As an energy in the present, or as a mood or a feeling. So then this is awakening to the way it is. Now if fear is quite a basic emotion that this realm, that the animals have, that we have. Nothing, it's not like some personal neurotic problem, and we might think of it as such, that our ideal is not to be afraid, to be fearless would be what we would like, what we would want. But in terms of experience, what, you know, if one is still bound and blinded to this realm that we're living in, and really operating on survival or conditioned habit. There's no, you know, then we just, we end up trying to, you know, control everything. One of the biggest fears we have is losing control, isn't it? What if I lose control? What if I go crazy? What if I lose my mind? That's one of the fears people have when they come to meditation, isn't it? Of you know, maybe I'll just go crazy. Because the you know, if we can hold on, if we have a sense of controlling, then we can create this illusion of safety. In modern society, we're always demanding safety. We want peace, and we want security. We want all this to be, you know, to make our lives seem and make us feel that everything's going to be all right. And then, of course, like the Twin Towers catastrophe for the Americans, that must have been an enormous kind of shock. From what people tell me, in a country that has kind of developed a sense of safety, attitude of the America of my day. When I lived there, it was very much, we're far away from the rest, where the wars take place, either in the Asian or the European, or in Africa, or some place like that. But so we've got to protect ourselves and keep away from these things that are happening in the rest of the world. And then the Twin Towers catastrophe was like, such a shock, because it was from within rather than some kind of missile coming from outside. It was American Airlines, you know, it was airplanes that are owned by the Americans and with American people in them. And the suicide bombers were trained in America. And like this, suddenly this, one's sense of safety and security is shattered, and this is very distressing. And it's shocking and it's distressing. But this world is like this, and it doesn't take very long to look back and just see how you know, if human beings don't, you know, harm each other, then nature always has its way. You know, suddenly it'll be a volcano or a cyclone or a flood or some natural disaster, because this realm is like this. Its very nature is insecure. It's the experience of uncertainty, of not knowing, of being in this state in a very kind of vulnerable and sensitive state that we have very little control over. And the more we try to control it and create this illusion of security and safety, then of course we're in for the shocks, because even in the most secure countries, you know, with the best political economic systems and democratic systems, people are continually getting upset, shocked, disappointed, disillusioned by, not if it's not natural disasters, it's the loss of loved ones, or being humiliated, or being rejected, or getting old and nobody loves you when you're old and gray. Feeling of These are so common even in the most secure and safe environments, this natural flow from birth to death. When I was in Switzerland recently, in a country that kind of symbolizes a nation that has, seems to have almost perfected the sense of security and of orderliness. You know, always such a beautiful country that is so clean and well ordered, well run, and yet the shock Switzerland is going through right now with its, economies not doing so well. The Swiss Air is bankrupt, of all things. And things are happening that just come out of the blue. Some Swiss man went into a government building in Zug and just took a gun and shot down about 14 people. And he was Swiss. He wasn't like some foreigner going in. So this also, you feel, I think Switzerland, a sense of shock and of this false sense of security is suddenly being challenged. What have we got to depend on? You know, everything's falling apart. We're losing control. Blame it on somebody. You know, so you find something. You know, the somebody to Osama bin Laden is a good one, or. If he wasn't around, you'd find somebody else, or a group of people, or a nation, or a race, or something, because we think if we can just find what the cause of all this is and get rid of it, then we'll have this illusion back again. Everything will be all right. So then, the advice of the Buddha, the encouragement is to awaken to the way it is. Like Dhamma is, putting it into an English definition, the truth of the way it is. And this has to come not from me telling you the truth of the way it is, but from you trusting in your own direct experience of life. You know, so it's a kind of gut level of knowing. It's not knowing about. It's not abstract knowledge that somebody else can tell you the way it is and define it out and describe it and you just have to believe what I say or some expert says. But in this awakening, when we call meditation, it's awakening to the way it is, whatever way it is right now. Doesn't have to be any certain way, but just being able to trust yourself to treasure, to value this ability that each one of us has to awaken to this moment, to feel this moment, to be this moment, to allow it to be the way it is, even if it is unpleasant, if it's painful or boring or pleasant or whatever. The quality is not the important thing. The way is through paying attention, of knowing it in this direct way. So then this of course means that it's up to each one of us to do it. that I can't expect you to awaken me, because that's an impossibility. Or that I awaken you, that's an impossibility. Or that there's anybody, even a Buddha or an Arahant, can awaken us. So when I say awake, then you might even grasp the idea, I must wake, awake, awake, and then hold to some idea, ideal of awakeness. Or just wake up. It's like this morning, talking about leaping out of bed with alacrity. Don't think about it, just do it. You know, it's not, you know, the more you think about it, the more you don't want to do it. It gets complicated, and the mind you know, pretty soon you'll find yourself unable to get up on a cold, unless you really want to get up. But if you to get up early on a cold winter's morning, when you're under a nice, cozy duvet, and to leap out of that warmth into the cold, if you think about it, you can't do it. At least I can't. I just do it. So in waking up, it's just a matter of paying attention. Then many of us are, you know, we have these ideas about meditation, how you've got to get samadhi first. Before you can wake up, you have to have samadhi. That's the general delusion that you hear. In order to be fully awake, I have to have samadhi. So we spend time trying to get samadhi. Some idea of tranquility or jhana or something that will you know, that some ideal that we should get before we can really awaken. So we grasp the idea of I have to get samadhi first. And then wake up through samadhi. Or is this such a simple thing, so ordinary, that the idea of by even naming it makes it complicated. Call it mindfulness or sati sampajanya. That makes it sound quite complicated. And using Pali terminologies. Well, then we sati sampajanya, we have to translate that into English, and that can get into complications. What are the exact English equivalents to sati sampajanya? And then there are various arguments around that. So it's not a matter of having to define and you know, figure it all out before you do it, but trusting in your direct experience. So just test yourself out. What is the awakening right now? Very simple. So I experience it. You know, I'm going to speak from my own experience, because I don't know what you're doing right now. just opening, receiving this moment, being, you know, allowing this moment to be the way it is. I'm not here to judge it or you know, grasp it or to even name it. It's this way. And if you begin to trust in this, trust it, then you don't need to name it. You don't need to figure it out on the level of terminology, and and follow a kind of recipe from the scripture. But the important thing is to really trust in this simple, imminent act. Now then, emotionally, of course, we're not conditioned for this. You know, we get full of doubt. Am I really awake, or am I just fooling myself? Am I, You know, does Ajahn Sumedho know what he's talking about? Or you might assume that I have some kind of special ability that I've developed because I've been a monk for so long, and that you're just a beginner, and you know, you've got so many emotional problems difficulties that you can't possibly, you know, can't possibly be the same. But awakeness is the same. It's not mine. It's nothing personal. It's nothing that I've, that I've cultivated and that has the, you know, that I've gained through a lot of control. In fact, I spent many years trying to get samadhi, and only to fail. I'd get it and then I'd lose it. You know, when I get something I call samadhi, then I keep losing it. And so you keep, you know, whatever you get, you're going to lose. Gain and loss, they go together. So if you get enlightenment, you're going to lose it. Or you get samadhi, you're going to lose. Whatever you get, you're going to lose. So if you're getting beyond gain and loss, then that can only be in this present moment of where you don't get anything and you don't lose anything. It's just so, this learning to trust, relax, open, receive. Then doubt arises, and the complications of our intellect and our emotional habits. But then this is the way it is. Trust yourself to be aware of what it's like to feel confused or doubtful, uncertain, despairing, whatever kind of emotions come up in this present moment in regards to meditation practice. And what you're trusting is not what your emotions are saying and they're telling you, or what the jackal is accusing you of, or whatever, but the awareness of that. So this sense of it, the jackal belongs, the giraffe, the dark side, the good side, angels and devils, boredom, being fed up, angry, or whatever. If this is what's happening, then that which is aware, be the awareness of it, and learning to trust. This is a relaxed way of being also. It's not, you know, if you more you try to get it, then, you know, this willfulness of trying to get it and hold to it and all that. So if you get something, you'll lose it. So what is it that is, will receive both gain and loss? Success and failure, praise and blame, happiness and suffering. The only thing I can find in my experience at the moment is in my ability to embrace this moment, to be fully with whatever. Gain, loss, success, failure. Doesn't matter. They all belong, and it's not a matter of that failure or loss is some kind of sign of your inability to meditate, unless you are firmly convince yourself that this is a problem, then it becomes one. That's why I keep reiterating and encouraging this saddha, or this faith, this trustingness. And you have to recognize it's from here. It's in the in here, it's not an ideal that you have to cultivate. There's some kind of thing that you will get in the future if you do all the right things. It's natural to us. It's our true nature. It's not something difficult or dependent on conditions being ideal. We think of ideal situations, the ideal monastery, where everything is you know, we can think of where it just fits all our highest hopes and ideas, a place where there's happy monks and happy nuns and everything's fair and everything's, you know, there's the right balance of everything and it's well supported and there's separate kutis for each one. And we have many hours a day to develop samadhi, and we, you know, we have excellent teacher, perfect teacher, great compassionate master, and on like this. This ideal monastery, where there's no noise, no planes flying overhead, no sounds of traffic, where people, when they come in, they immediately go into a quiet state. There's no kind of disruptive things. But this realm isn't like that, is it? This realm is like this. It's noisy, it's erratic, things just happen. And we try to, you know, choose places to live in. Like when we came to the UK, I remember, you know, we didn't want to live in London. Because we all thought, we can't meditate in London. Too noisy. Big city, pollution, and we'll find the ideal situation. So we have found rather ideal places to live, Chithurst and here and so forth. So you've got, getting rather beautiful spots in Italy and in Switzerland and New Zealand and Australia and California, but still, with all the best conditions, if you don't ever have the faith and trust in your own ability to awaken, you can spend the rest of your life sitting in a kuti or in a cave under the most ideal conditions and not never get the point. Because if you start with a lot of views and opinions and ideals, and you never see what you're doing, you know, then you'll always end up with this sense of failure or fear of losing control. I remember when I was into my controlling phase, how angry I'd get at noisy things that would come by. How really upset I could get over little things, because somebody didn't do their chore, or somebody, you know, is not playing the game properly, or somebody makes too much noise, or whatever. Get really indignant, feel I can't stand this place, because this and that and. And so we can spend our life trying to find perfect place. And even if we find it, something will happen. If it's not from external conditions, it'll be from internal ones. I remember going on retreats where the conditions were as good as you can get, and then being stuck with some really heavy internal doubts and obsession. Or you're struggling with, you know, you can't blame it on anybody or the external condition, but you're stuck with yourself. And the way the emotions and the fears and the guilt and the despair can really take you over, can really completely dominate your conscious experience day in and day out. But if you trust in awakening, in this simple imminent act of awakeness, more and more, really appreciate it, notice it. What is it really like? And not just, you know, really value it. It's precious, and yet it's ordinary. It's not something difficult. It's not refined, like you have to have everything just perfect in order to have it. Awakeness is anywhere, in the midst of the battlefield or in the midst of total confusion or in a peaceful setting or whatever. The environment is not really the problem. Because you get down to the base problem, it's ignorance, avijja, vajjaya, sankhara. It's avijja, ignorance of not knowing the way it is. We can idealize, we can create ideas of how we would like everything to be, perfect monastery and so forth, but that's another complication, isn't it? An ideal is another complication. With our intellect, we can create ideals. We can imagine how everything should be. And how I should be. You know, I can very good at creating images of what I would like to be, how I should be. But trusting in awareness more than there's a sense of myself and my tendency to create ideas and ideals and the emotional habits that are any, you know, not ideal by any means. Many of my emotional habits are what I don't want, but they are this way. So I trust in the awareness of them. The awareness allows my emotion, whatever it might be in the present, to be the way it is. Not making any deals with it or judging it, but noticing and recognizing and allowing. So that is when learning to trust in awareness is also at the same time you're developing patience, because it you know, intellectually, when you're very idealistic, you're very impatient. You can imagine how things should be, and you want them right now to be that way, to be the ideal, rather than being patient, allowing life to flow and be imperfect and noisy and confusing and frustrating and loopy and whatnot. It's all right via the sense of losing control. It's like this. A sense of not being good enough, not being pure enough or whatever. It's like this. Doubting, not being sure. It's like this. Or feeling confused and insecure and vulnerable, is like this. When I say like this, the way it is, this to me is a way of trying to explain the sense of embracing, of receiving, and allowing, and the the complexities of this realm to coexist, to be the way they are. So if you, now I find from my own practice, the more I trust in this, that I have an increasing sense of strength and confidence. I've been really present, this is the result to me of this practice, because I'm getting beyond the limitations of my own personality. I'm not stuck with the conventions that I'm in, or the ideals that I have, or the fears and desires that I experience in consciousness. Realizing what we would call the unconditioned or the deathless, the reality that allows all conditions to arise and cease. So in getting to the root of it, isn't it, is getting beyond, getting to the point where there is this imminent sense of attention and presence before before you start identifying with anything. And because we aren't used to it, then it's so easily ignored. You know, it doesn't seem like anything to our worldly mind. It seems like nothing. Where, you know, if to gain a goal, to say, work hard and you will achieve, you know, really practice hard and put up, you know, goals for you to attain. And there's part of me, my personality used to like that a lot, wanting, you know, to apply myself and, you know, coming from the background, the cultural background I'm from is very much, you know, goal-oriented, to achieve and attain things, to really prove myself, to get rid of my defilement and to attain purity. But it doesn't work that way. They recognize the convention or form that we use, and say the Theravada tradition, the monastic system, now I mean this is you might call it, put it in terms of a lifestyle, way of living your life, that we choose. It's not forced on any of us. We have to request and choose to take on this way of life. Then recognize it's, you know, and it has certain good aspects and certain, it's not perfect, you know, it has its problems also. It's the way conventional reality is. So if you're expecting perfection from this convention, you'll be terribly disappointed, as most of you are aware of by now, that the convention itself is like this. You know, it's an old tradition. So we recite 227 seven Patimokkha rules along, we don't, you know, don't apply to anything that we can relate to in our daily life. We still recite them, and then our kind of utilitarian, functional, and practical way of looking at it is we can get rid of this one, that one, or is it a matter of trying to make a perfect Patimokkha or Vinaya, or for me, what I do is I accept it, the tradition, and by that I accept both its positive and its negative aspect. Because to me, it gives me a way of living that encourages awareness, this awakenness. It has a power behind it, and you can see, you know, from living here at Amaravati, the generosity and the kind of support that comes to this monastery. Yeah. It's not, you know, is quite surprising and even miraculous in a way. So it has, you know, this is how I see it, but it does have a tremendous kind of power behind it, as survival. Just the fact that it survived for 2,500 years is quite remarkable, and still operative and workable within a modern European country like this one. So they're not making a problem about it, but learning to how to use it. It's an art, it's a skill, rather than just seeing it, taking it too personally or too idealistically. You know, trying to put it in terms of idealizing the convention, or just being endlessly frustrated by the things you don't like about it. And being obsessed with that which you don't like about it or don't agree with. To me, there's nothing so terribly wrong with it that I can't, you know, that I totally couldn't accept it. It's basic, you know, it's moral, it's based on, you know, the idea of sila, samadhi, panya. So then how to use it. And this, you have to trust yourself too. You know, we can tell you, you know, we can instruct you and various things, but ultimately it depends on you, how you're going to use this convention. And to know how to use this convention, you have to trust in the awakened, intuitive sense rather than your ideal sense, or just the intimidation and the views and opinions that are inevitably generated from conventions such as this. And you can hear so many views and opinions about how it should be, or what's right and what's wrong, and this way we can fuss over trivialities endlessly, just because we want to be right, feel that we're right, this is the right thing, the experts say so. Or trusting in one's own sense, you know, intuitive sense, not in views and opinions or emotional reactions to it. And of course, this is up to you, you know, to I can only encourage you that how you do this is, what you do with it is strictly your business. We can see the conventional, the conventions in terms of, you know, just of we have to conform, we have to obey, and we have to institutionalize ourselves. We have to make ourselves into good monks and nuns. That's one way of looking at it. But that, to me, is oppressive. You know, me trying to endlessly become this ideal monk and always trying to, you know, like trying to be a good boy all the time, trying to live up to the high standards and ideals of our noble lifestyle, and let, you know, I find this, you know, doesn't work for me. At the end of the day, I never feel good enough on a personal level. I can never be pure enough or good enough if I just follow this ideal that I have. But I do trust in the awakening to this ideal. The ideal's fine, nothing wrong with the ideal. And I'm not trying to put it down or say there's anything wrong with having ideals. But the awakened, intuitive state knows the limitation of ideals. You know, we're not bound to ideals. Awakenedness allows us to respond to life whatever way it happens to be. And and life is never going to be ideal. Because it can't be, it's not an ideal, it's like this. It's feeling, it's changing. It moves from birth to death, from pleasure to pain, from right to wrong, good and evil. It's, you have changes day and night, and summer and winter, and I mean, this is the way it is. It's an ideal would be like Garden of Eden might be the ideal we have from the Old Testament, the Garden of Eden, where everything's just perfect. We're one with God, we're all happy all the time, we're innocent, and we're pure all the time. And everything's fair, and everything's love, and everything's incredibly nice, beautiful. Perfect is an ideal. Then we can look at London or Birmingham or Amaravati or whatever. And, you know, we find plenty of things wrong with all of these places. I don't quite live up to the ideal of the Garden of Eden. But the awareness, isn't it? Allows life to be, to change according to its nature. It's, and so we're learning to awaken to what we really are. And so what we really are is, we're not anything. We're not anybody. But we are this pure awareness, this very natural state of being that we can recognize and realize within the problems and difficulties and limitations of human sensory conditioning. And so see, you know, each one of us then is the center of the universe. No, this is the center here. Not me. I'm not pointing to myself as a person. But just common sense, doesn't it, when you really awaken. Where do you experience life? Always from here. You can't experience life from where I am. you might like to, you might think you would like to experience life where Ajahn Sumedho is, or but that's an impossible, that's a, you know, hopeless, foolish wish, because you you can only experience it from here, the way it is. And the way it is isn't going to always be the same, for even though we might be sitting on the same seat under all the same conditions, the way it is according to our karma, isn't it? The way we're feeling, the state of your health, the emotional habits, whatever they might be, the cultural conditioning, social conditioning, your age, and on and like this. But the awakened state is one. It's where, you know, it's not personal. It's not mine in terms of some kind of personal achievement. So we begin to realize the oneness rather than make problems about differences between you and me. So I'm offering this as a reflection only. Anything that I've said here is for consideration, reflection, but mainly it's an encouragement to trust. Don't think, you know, even if you think you can't do it, just being aware of your own doubts. That's it, that awareness. See, if you, whatever you're thinking right now or feeling, if you're totally confused by what I'm saying, you know, be aware, trust in the awareness of being confused, of confusion, of uncertainty or doubt. Trust in that, awaken awareness rather than always bind yourself to the condition. No, you're confused. I don't want to be confused. I want clarity. I want clear lines. I want certitude. Give me a recipe, Ajahn Sumedho. What should I do next? Then that kind of thing. Awakening to that desire for clear lines, for certainty in life. And trust in just that awareness of it. And it's like this, wanting, desiring, not wanting. It's like this. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.